So I want to start by thinking about, why does friendship matter? Without not merely love, but the specific love of friendship, human history would have to be rewritten. Had Jonathan and David not enjoyed a friendship so deep that one could speak of the other as another self, and David describe their love as more dear to me than the love of a woman, Jonathan would never have risked his life to warn his friend David of the life-threatening rage of his father. And had King Saul killed David, not only would the history of Israel, but of the entire world, been changed by the lack of a king after the Lord's own heart, and consequently of the King of Kings descended from him. Had there not been a deep and true spiritual friendship between Teresa of Avila and John of the Cross, the world would never have read some of the most beautiful mystical poetry ever composed, and the living flame of love would have been quenched in a dark prison cell of the very unfriendly rejection of John by his own religious brothers. If two friends had not discussed life, literature, and the very possibility of Christianity over a friendly pint of ale at a pub in Oxford, not only might Middle Earth and Narnia have been far less magical, but Aslan might never have even been born a cub in Lewis's imagination if he had lacked Tolkien's amicable challenge to his friend's agnosticism. These few examples, among many, point to the reality that friendship can hardly be ignored without dire consequence for humanity. If we take God's word for it, both the rareness and the value of friendship have been attested in the book of Sirach, where it is written, "A faithful friend is a sturdy shelter. He that has found one has found a treasure. There is nothing so precious as a faithful friend. Whoever fears the Lord directs his friendship aright, for as he is, so is his neighbor also." Long before the coming of Christ, the Greek philosophers pondered the diverse loves that enrich the human experience. Aristotle, in his Nicomachean Ethics, painted a portrait of friendship that not only stirred the minds of his contemporaries, but which lit a spark of recognition of truth in St. Thomas Aquinas. When Aquinas writes of charity as friendship in the Summa Theologiae, question 23, article 1 of the Secunda Secundae, it is no surprise that he calls upon the philosopher, Aristotle, as his first source in his response. Aristotle's philosophical wisdom often provides the rational basis for Aquinas' theological reflections. And on the topic of human friendship, Aquinas embraces Aristotle's insights as found in the Nicomachean Ethics, but draws them into the wider embrace of divine revelation in Christ. So I want to look with you first at what Aristotle says briefly on friendship in the Ethics. And this is the foundation that really Thomas builds on in his own writings later. Aristotle views ethics as a science at the service of the search for the good, the ultimate good of man being happiness, which he notes both the common and the educated identify with living well and acting well. If for Aristotle, wisdom leads to happiness by the perfection of the capacity to know the truth, friendship leads to happiness by a certain perfection of the capacity to love the good. Since, as Aristotle writes, without friends, no one would choose to live, though he had all other goods. Thus, establishing friendship's key role in human happiness, Aristotle dedicates extensive consideration to friendship in books 8 and 9 of the Nicomachean Ethics. First, we'll look at what he sees as the three kinds of friendship. Aristotle first distinguishes three principal kinds of friendship based on the objects of love. So what we love together with the other determines the kind of friendship we have with them. He says, "For not everything seems to be loved, but only the lovable. And this is the good, the pleasant, or the useful." While he admits that a certain limited type of friendship can be based on pleasure or use, this can never be friendship in its fullest sense. Love that is based on usefulness, as for example, when your tooth hurts and you go to a good dentist, you love the dentist for the sake of the usefulness and ending the toothache, falls short, obviously, of the friendship of virtue. For as Aristotle writes, Now, those who love each other for their utility do not love each other for themselves, but in virtue of the good that they derive from each other, obviously. Aristotle further observes that friendship of utility is the shortest lived, for when the usefulness ends, there's no need for a further relationship. And he says it's the most likely to produce quarrels. He's very practical, Aristotle. Whereas, likewise, love based on pleasure, that you share a common thing you enjoy, okay, has this imperfection of overemphasis on self-fulfillment. Since those who love for the sake of pleasure do so for the sake of what is pleasant to themselves. So he's not saying that there can't be a love that also involves usefulness and pleasure, okay? But that if that's the principal motive for the friendship, it will always fall short of something deeply perfecting. Central to true friendship, however, is precisely, for Aristotle, its other-centeredness, its desire for the true good of the one loved for the sake of the one who is loved. So it really it has this amazing outward focus, the good of the other. This, for Aristotle, is true benevolence or goodwill, which is absolutely indispensable for virtuous friendship. Furthermore, he says that it's not sufficient for one friend to have this benevolence and not the other. Benevolence in a perfect friendship, Aristotle says, has to be mutual. It has to be known and willed by both. Thus, Aristotle summarizes the first two necessary elements of a true friendship, writing, "To be friends, then, they must be mutually recognized as bearing goodwill and wishing well to each other." This mutual benevolence that is known to both persons requires, for Aristotle, that they share a certain likeness. And for him, the greatest likeness you can share to another as a foundation for friendship is likeness in virtue. Lorraine Smith Pangle describes this Aristotelian sense of affinity due to likeness in this way. A strong and healthy soul takes a natural delight in contemplating other strong and healthy souls in action, both because they are beautiful and because they are akin. So this very classical idea that when a person is virtuous, there is a great beauty in that, a great integrity in that, that is admirable in and of itself, is one level of appreciation of the good of the other. But when they share that likeness in virtue, that is the best foundation for friendship there is. So that this likeness be rooted in virtue is what follows. For a person to want what is good for another, the person must know what is truly good, and therefore must be virtuous. You are probably familiar with, in the system of ethics of Aristotle, virtue is not only at the level of moral virtue, it's also at the level of intellectual virtue. So if the only way you can be a good friend to another person is to want what is truly good for that person, you have to know what the true good is. So it presupposes not only moral virtue, not only that we act well, but that we think well, intellectual virtue, okay? Which doesn't always come together with moral virtue. You can have one without the other in Aristotle's understanding and in Aquinas's. So even if a person feels a certain affinity for another, if the person is not already virtuous, the supposed friend, the one who desires to want the good of the other, can seek a false or illusory good for the other. Thus, Aristotle rightly observes, perfect friendship is the friendship of those who are good and alike in virtue, for these wish well alike to each other qua good, meaning as good itself. That's what you're wishing good as good. And they are good themselves. Aristotle observes that this superior kind of friendship embraces and includes the benefits of the lower forms. And that is because the true good always embraces what is most useful and what is most pleasurable. Because for Aristotle, the greatest pleasures are not reductive pleasures, they're the foolish pleasures, right? So he notes that while distance from one another doesn't necessarily break the friendship, the building and deepening of any friendship requires a sharing of life with the other. As he writes, "For those who live together delight in each other and confer benefits on one another." So for Aristotle, the truest friendship is only possible among equals. Now here's where he's going to run into a kind of understanding of friendship that is going to be radically changed when we get to Aquinas. Because Aristotle believed that you have to be equals who share this likeness and virtue. And concerning the equality of true friends, Aristotle roots the capacity for true friendship in virtuous self-love, using the beautiful expression that the friend is another self. L. Gregory Jones summarizes the connection between virtue and knowledge of self and of the other, asserting that, quote, one's mode of self-relation determines the mode of one's relation to the other. This will be taken up in the whole intellectual and the whole Catholic theological tradition, that you can only love another if you have a healthy self-love, and you can only know what's good for another if you have an understanding of what is good for yourself. But this sense of the need for equality is, for Aristotle, the principal barrier to any possibility with friendship between humans and gods. Okay, he uses sometimes gods in the plural, sometimes in the singular. Speaking of this unbridgeable gap created by significant inequality, he writes, "This becomes clear if there is a great interval in respect of virtue or vice or wealth or anything else between the parties. For then they are no longer friends and do not even expect to be so. And this is the most manifest in the case of the gods, for they surpass us most decisively in all good things." So Aristotle sees not only in the human community would there be an impossibility of really true friendship amongst those that are not equals. And this could be in a relational sense. He didn't think that a parent could be a true child to a true friend to a child. He didn't think that even in marriage you could be truly friends because of the inequality he saw between peoples. He certainly thought that amongst different social classes you couldn't have true friendship, but he thought this was most profound in relation to any concept of a divinity and humans. He later, even referring to God in the singular, asserts the utter impossibility of friendship between him and man, saying, "When one party is removed to a great distance, as God is, the possibility of friendship ceases." So even in pondering the possibility of there being a singular understanding of God, he still thought it was impossible that there could be friendship. There could be other love. There could be a kind of honor, a kind of reverence, but not friendship. For Aristotle, friendship, like all habits of the soul, is perfected when it's brought into action. It's not enough to just have the habit, but actually to that potential be realized. Thus, he describes the acts or effects of the friendship of virtue. First, a friend wills and does what is good for the sake of the friend. Second, a friend wills that his friend live and exist for the other's sake. Third, a friend shares life with his friend, including having the same tastes, as well as sharing joys and sorrows with one another. Thus, for Aristotle, friendship is not only caused by a certain likeness and goodness, but it also forms that goodness in the friend. So likeness and goodness is causal to friendship, but also it is more deeply formed by the friendship. Paul Waddell comments on this understanding of Aristotle's: friendship is the dynamic, vital activity whereby those devoted to what is good are, in the crucible of friendship, gradually chiseled into people alike in goodness. So there's a formative quality to friendship. In his final considerations on friendship in Book 9 of the Nicomachean Ethics, Aristotle elaborates his earlier assertion of the need for friends to share life together, describing the pleasure they derive from this association. He makes an analogy to explain how significant this genuine, concrete communion is to friendship. Just as the lover longs to see the beloved, so the friend longs to share time with the befriended. Does it not follow then that as for lovers, the sight of the beloved is the thing they love most, he writes, and they prefer this sense to the others because on it love depends most for its being and for its origin. So for friends, the most desirable thing is living together. He illustrates this with examples, showing that whatever activity is important to a person, from gambling to contemplation, he longs to share with his friend. Writing, "For since they wish to live with their friends, they do and share in those things which give them the sense of living together. This sharing of activities they most enjoy makes bad men even worse and good men even better," according to Aristotle. Because Aristotle sees the principal activity of man as the contemplation of truth, he envisions that the best possible sharing between two friends is rational. He must therefore perceive the existence of his friend together with his own, and this will be realized in their living together and their sharing in discussion and thought, he writes, for this is what living together would seem to mean in the case of humans and not in the case of cattle feeding in the same place. I love that quote. Because this distinction between an animal that literally by being in the same stall and munching out of the same feed bin would bind them together at an animal level is certainly not sufficient for human beings. It's not enough that we just share a common activity, but that the activity be the highest of activities, that we think together, we discuss together, we share our ideas together. This rational sharing does not exclude, but rather includes, the sharing of the passions, since he earlier describes friends as a friend as one who grieves and rejoices with his friend. Thus, Aristotle's understanding of the sharing of the life of friends embraces an actual and total sense of living together. Union of wills by benevolence, union of minds through conversation, and union of passions through communion or sharing of our sorrows and joys. I'm now going to look at St. Thomas Aquinas' understanding built on Aristotle's, but extended and kind of expanded in his view of the gospel. This threefold consideration of friendship in terms of benevolence, mutuality, and sharing of life not only receives treatment in Aquinas' philosophical commentary on the Nicomachean Ethics, but it's also taken up and reconsidered in light of revelation in his theological writings. As Father Romanus Cesario observes, Thomas describes charity as friendship, not merely because of his esteem for Aristotle, but because Aristotle's explanation of friendship elucidates what the New Testament calls koinonia, or in Latin, communicatio. In his exploration of the supernatural realities given us by divine revelation, Aquinas never neglects the foundation of natural truth, accessible to reason, on which they build. Friendship's necessity for happiness in Aquinas. In the Summa Theologiae, St. Thomas Aquinas discusses friendship in two of the most central parts of his consideration of the moral life. Firstly, in his discussion of happiness, and then in his discussion of the virtue, the theological virtue especially, of charity. Like Aristotle, Aquinas places friendship among the chief components of happiness. Eberhard Schockenhoff notes that Aquinas, agreeing with Aristotle, places great emphasis on the final end, which is what gives human acts their unity. I mean, if you study even a little Aristotle, his whole understanding of the way we act is that we're always acting towards an end. And ends are what give to our actions unity. So when we perceive the end, when we move towards it with clarity, with truth, then we become good in Aristotle's understanding of action. But Aquinas' view builds on Aristotle's. It doesn't deny it, but he says that this happiness isn't simply a happiness of this world, but it's a happiness that has a theological component. Human practice does not find its point of unity in itself, but is completed in communion with God as the unique, fulfilling good. This communion is effected for Aquinas by the virtue of charity. In the Summa, Aquinas poses the question of whether the fellowship of friends is necessary for happiness. So we already saw this in Aristotle. But it's interesting, with this typical clarity, St. Thomas Aquinas distinguishes between happiness in this life and happiness in eternity. Regarding happiness in this life, Aquinas states, if we speak of the happiness of this life, the happy man needs friends. As the philosopher Aristotle says in the Ethics, Book 9, not indeed to make use of them, since he suffices himself if he's a virtuous man, nor to delight in them, since he possesses perfect delight in the operation of virtue, but for the purpose of a good operation. So in other words, in order to do good. Namely, that he may do good to them, and that he may delight in seeing them do good. And again, that he may be helped by them in his good work. So he thinks it's part of the perfection of happiness that we have someone that we can do good things for, and that we can perceive the goods they do, and together we can rejoice in the good that is done. That's Aquinas' understanding of the importance of friendship for this life. Aquinas further points out that the help friends give each other in doing the good applies to both the active and the contemplative lives. So it's not a matter of just doing good works. It's actually of sharing a contemplation of truth as the greatest rational good that man can pursue. When he answers in terms of eternal life, Aquinas cites the scriptures and St. Augustine. Since the vision of God is the principal aspect of heaven, then it seems that man does not need friends in the happiness of eternity. But in the body of the argument, he affirms that while there is this primary happiness of seeing God in heaven for the blessed, who receive no other interior aid to happiness than the eternity, truth, and charity of the Creator, he still admits a role even in heaven for human friendship. He writes, "But if they can be said to be helped from without, perhaps it is only by this, that they see one another and rejoice in God at their fellowship." Thus, without in any way diminishing the perfection of happiness that flows from seeing God, what is the beatific vision, Aquinas nevertheless preserves the dignity of human friendship, whose fellowship brings delight even in the life to come in eternity. What we call in theology the communion of saints, that we rejoice more because we are together in the Lord. The nature of friendship in Aquinas. Charity as friendship with God and neighbor. Having upheld the necessity of friendship for happiness in this life, and even its continuation in the happiness of eternity, Aquinas explores the nature of friendship in his treatise on the theological virtues, identifying friendship with the greatest of the virtues, charity. In question 23 of the second part of the second part, Thomas affirms that charity is indeed friendship. Because charity is primarily treated as a theological virtue, the first objection to identifying charity with friendship centers on the seeming impossibility of being the friend of God. He first considers the apparent lack of sharing a life between God and man, which makes it seem that charity is not friendship. In his reply to this objection, Aquinas admits that in our bodily lives in this world, we're capable of only imperfect spiritual fellowship with God. But he notes that charity will be perfected in heaven, where spiritual communion will be perfect. But the second objection to considering friendship as charity concerns the mutuality or reciprocity of friendship. And this objection Aquinas raises in relation to charity to neighbor. Jesus calls his disciples to exercise charity through love of their enemies. But such a one-sided love could never be equated with friendship if you understand Aristotle's understanding of friendship. But once again, Aquinas makes a distinction, noting that friendship extends to a person either in respect to the person him or herself or in respect to another person. In respect of himself, a person loves those who truly are his friends. But in respect of another, a person can love all those who are dear to that person's friends. So you can extend the love of a friend to those who are not in themselves your friends. Therefore, a person who is the friend of God, Thomas reasons, loves all people, even his or her own enemies, for the sake of God, who is the primary object of charity. Thus, one can love his enemies for the sake of God without compromising the nature of friendship as mutual in Thomas's thought. This argument he also applies to the problem raised in the third objection. Charity is obviously not equated with the imperfect friendships of use or pleasure, but if virtuous friendship requires a likeness in virtue between both parties, it seems that virtuous friendship would exclude an unvirtuous enemy. But he uses the same argument as he used for the second objection, showing that you could love an enemy for the sake of your love for a virtuous friend. And so you're, for the sake of the one who is virtuous, you can love even the unvirtuous person, and especially if that love is your love for God. So he's saying, so if you really do love God, in his understanding, you could love all people, even your own enemies, even those who aren't virtuous, with a kind of friendship. Now, I think Aristotle would object to this, but this is Thomas's understanding. The body of the article directly flows from Aristotle's three requirements for friendship, namely benevolence, mutuality, and the sharing of life. The love of charity obviously shares a mutual benevolence proper to virtuous friendship, since both require wanting the good for the other, not merely for oneself, but for the sake of the other. In the sharing or communication of good is the best evidence, according to Aquinas, of identifying charity with friendship. For he writes, since there is a communication between man and God, inasmuch as he communicates his happiness to us, Some kind of friendship must needs be based on this same communication, of which it is written, God is faithful, by whom you are called unto the fellowship of his Son. The love which is based on this communication is charity. Wherefore, it is evident that charity is the friendship of man for God. Aquinas concludes that charity, as both the virtue of love for God and for neighbor, is therefore friendship in all three senses. But friendship not only enters into his discussion of the virtue of charity, it's also in his treatment of the passions or the emotions. In the Prima Secundae, the first part of the second part, question 26 of the Summa, Aquinas examines love as a passion of the concupiscible appetite. If you understand Thomas's understanding of the person, he says that our emotions are in two different categories. We have some emotions that are part of what he calls the concupiscible appetite. What is that? It's just the appetite for simple goods in our everyday living. Okay, so he says some of our emotions are just the responding to a perceived good at a normal everyday level. That's the concupiscible appetite, okay? The irascible appetite is kind of like your emergency emotions. When you perceive a very difficult good to achieve or a great evil that you have to avoid, you have a set of emotions that are for emergencies. They're strong emotions. They're only meant to go into action when there's something really difficult to achieve or difficult to avoid. But our normal everyday emotions, the emotions that perceive a good and desire to be one with that good. You see, you smell a great meal and you want to eat it, okay? That's the concupiscible appetite, okay? That's what he's talking about, this set of emotions. When he's talking about those emotions, he says, they cause one to move toward a desired object and rest in its possession with joy. That's the pattern of the emotions. You see the good, you perceive it as good, you want to be united to it, you desire it, you move towards it, and then you enjoy it when you embrace it, okay? Aquinas distinguishes love as love of friendship and love of concupiscence. So at the emotional level of love, he sees that there is a kind of friendship love that's emotional, but there's also a kind of emotional love that is just of the appetite of desire. Aquinas distinguishes the love of concupiscence as that toward a good desired for oneself or another, which is love only relatively. Because you actually want the good for yourself in that passion. He sees that that's love, but it's relative love. Whereas he sees that the love of friendship, because it's completely about moving towards the good for the other, is actually love simply. And this is love simple, a simple kind of love, because it's for the sake of the one loved, not for the sake of any other good. So simple in Aquinas' terminology is not easy. It means undivided. Okay, so in his treatment of emotions, he looks at love could be considered from its emotional appetite of self-fulfillment, or it could be looked at principally in terms of emotionally wanting the good of the other, and that's a form of friendship. So therefore, he reasons that this twofold division of looking at love in this way is appropriate. While the Summa Theologiae contains the most extensive and explicit ideas he has on friendship, he will write about friendship in other works as well. And in chapters 21 and 22 of his Summa Contra Gentiles, the fourth book, he revisits the aspect of friendship defined by Aristotle, considering how these understandings of friendship at the human level can apply to our relationship with God. Writing about the divine friendship effected in man by the indwelling of the Holy Spirit, Aquinas applies these elements of human friendship. He speaks first in chapter 21 of the sharing of secrets, which he calls the proper mark of friendship. It's very interesting. He doesn't think it's just communication, but communication about what one holds very intimate inside oneself. So this sharing of secrets, which he calls the proper mark of friendship, adding the explanation that since charity unites affections and makes, as it were, one heart of two, one seems not to have dismissed from his heart that which he reveals to a friend. So he actually sees that there's such a deep unity in friendship that if you were to reveal even like the innermost thoughts of your mind, of your heart, that in a sense it remains within you because of the unity you have with this friend. Unity of affection also calls for sharing of all one's goods, since, says Aquinas, the friend is another self. A third aspect of friendship he writes of here is that of pardon, forgiveness, mercy, which Aquinas explains in this sense. He writes, by the fact that one is established as the friend of another, every offense is removed because friendship and offense are contraries. So this portrait of friendship, I think, is one of notable intimacy on every level of personhood. In chapter 22 that follows what I just read from, Aquinas continues the analysis of friendship, exploring the elements of the shared contemplation of truth, the resulting joy of that shared contemplation, and finally, consent to the will of the other. Aquinas echoes Aristotle's insistence that communion between friends necessarily includes conversation, that is, a sharing of the truths one has already discovered in contemplation. This is followed by a tender description of the joy experienced with true friends. Aquinas explains, "It is also a property of friendship that one take delight in a friend's presence, rejoice in his words and deeds, and find in him security against all anxieties. And so it is especially in our sorrows that we hasten to our friends for consolation." The unity of minds and affections of true friendship also fosters unity of will. Aquinas says that a friend readily consents to what is willed by his friend. Among the virtuous, this unity is strong, since the will is ordered to what is truly good. In virtuous human friendships, and even more so in divine, such union of wills does not compromise freedom, since virtue, or the grace of the Holy Spirit, inclines one to the true good. So we're moved from within by God if we're living a life that is in grace. And so he says, it doesn't crush your will. It's actually by a freedom of movement towards the good that two friends are most deeply united in that good. Aquinas further explains that since the object of the will is the true good by nature, he doesn't see that that's just something by grace. He says, this is what you were made for. Your mind was made to know the truth. Your will was made to pursue the good. So even at the level of nature, you have this inclination towards the truth and the good that should bind people together in friendship. He says that this movement toward the good sets us free from servitude to our lower appetites and enables us to embrace the highest good. This is the influence essential to friendship, as Aristotle outlined, the fostering with what is good along with respect for the otherness of the friend. So he wants to preserve both, that you'll be more like a person, deeper the friendship is, but that part of wanting their good is wanting their freedom. So it's not a one or the other. For him, it's both. If you're truly friends with another person, they grow in freedom and you grow in freedom because you're rooted in a good that doesn't negate your freedom, it fulfills your freedom. In the disputed questions on the virtues, Aquinas adds several interesting distinctions to his treatment of friendship. In Article 11 on the questions of charity, Aquinas reflects on the particular good of sharing life with a friend, the communication between them that brings mutual pleasure. He recalls that honorable friendship does not seek pleasure for pleasure's sake, but rather seeks the good, the other's good, which then results in pleasure. Aquinas never has a negative view of pleasure. He's from Southern Italy. He loves the pleasures of life, but he thinks they have to be pursued in a proper order. And so if I'm looking for the good of the other, he actually says that that will bring about a great pleasure, that you're genuinely seeking this other's good. In A Practical Insight, he notes that if the friendship is perfect, it will occasionally require that the friends forego the company of each other in order to do some good for one another. He writes, in this type of friendship, it shows greater love to be apart from the friend for his sake than to be unwilling to give up his company even for his sake. So I think this is interesting. As much as Aristotle and Aquinas insist on the shared life that's part of friendship, they recognize that if what grounds the friendship is the desire for the good of the other, it could require that they be apart from each other. In fact, it might require that for a long term, but it would not lose the grounding in friendship that they had from originally sharing the depths of their contemplation of truth. With characteristic realism, he concludes that if the separation comes too easily to the people, if one were to find greater pleasure in other things than in the company of the friend, it would point to a love that is weak or non-existent. So it's not that it comes easily that they part from one another. True friends like to be together. But if they're really rooted in pursuit of the good of the other, they recognize that certain necessities will cause a separation and that the bond isn't lost because the bond is rooted in the true good. In Aquinas' commentary on the Ethics, he highlights the effects of the shared life among friends as concord. In Daniel Schwartz's book, Friendship in Aquinas, he notes that concord is principally centered on choices rather than on opinions or beliefs. Schwartz summarizes this, writing, "Concord is the act of the habit of friendship by which one's choice of action is the same or closely related to that of the friend. Concord allows the friends to participate in the communicatio, or shared life, which is the basis of friendship. The need for concord makes it evident that virtuous people, who by virtue have more stability in acting, it's just part of the definition of virtue, are more able to sustain friendship via willing in harmony with one another. In light of the need for concord, it can also be concluded that one of the chief obstacles to friendship is pride. Because pride sows discord and conflict. When we're stubborn in our own perceptions and our own willing, we're not as able to enter into harmony with the willing of another. And so pride necessarily opposes friendship. If one is not proud, but humbly willing to seek concord, the friends are united by both goodwill and good deeds. This may, and often does, call for a sacrifice for the sake of the other. Sacrificing a material good for the benefit of a friend is not, in Aquinas' understanding, rooted in a lack of love for self or of an appreciation of material goods. There is nothing negative about the experience of being human and of the goodness of the material things of this world. It's not about not loving self, but it's about a properly ordered love for Aquinas. Schwartz concludes that in Aristotle's and Aquinas' view, willing and doing good do not demand selflessness, but rather a correct appreciation of what is really valuable. Thomas Aquinas actually says you can't love another if you don't love yourself. That self-love is part of being able. I mean, if you look at the Gospels, Jesus doesn't say, love your neighbor and don't love yourself. He says, love your neighbor as you love yourself. And Aquinas really understood this, that a healthy self-love is part of being able to have the capacity for friendship. So it's not that we have to be selfless in the wrong sense, but have to have a correct appreciation of the real values of things. Such appreciation engenders the sort of generosity that is particular to friendship. Thus, virtuous friendship does not entail devaluing oneself nor things, but rather a valuing of all that is good as ordered toward the true finality of each being. It's a very Aristotelian and Thomistic understanding. So it's evident that Aquinas goes beyond, but never contradicts, the fundamental Aristotelian insights on friendship. Benefiting from the added revelation of the incarnation and grace, Aquinas is able to conceive what Aristotle could not. How to reconcile the mutuality founded on the equality of friendship and the infinite distance between the divine and human natures. In Aquinas' understanding, in the grace of the redemption emerges the possibility of a true friendship between God and man and a greater understanding of friendship between humans. Yet even before the mysterious plan of God was revealed in Christ, Aristotle was able to discern the facets of natural human friendship whose truth has stood the test of time and which has informed the rich theological anthropology of St. Thomas. Jean-Pierre Torel captures the interdependence and yet revolutionary departure between the writings on friendship of Aristotle and Aquinas. He writes, though the philosopher, Aristotle, continues to furnish the definitional structure, the elements are radically changed because the good around which the communion between God and man is established, as well as the communion among men, is the divine life communicated by grace. So what's the saying is, friendship, as Aristotle understood it, is the structure Aquinas is using. But if you believe that there's not only this world, but a world to come, and that even in this world, the perfection of the human person is in relation to God, that's going to radically change the whole portrait of friendship. Because the end changes. Teleology is everything, right, for Aristotle. If you know the end, that's how you discern the means. So if you change the end, that if your understanding shifts, then you will change your perception of the means you need to get to that end. But even though Aquinas has this benefit of revelation, he never loses sight of the nature that is given to us, and he values human nature, and he sees that nature is a social nature. This social nature means that man does not journey, even if you see the destiny as God. We don't go to God alone, but rather in a community. Thus, the living of friendship is a crucial aspect not only of earthly happiness, but also of our salvation, a way of living our membership in the communion of saints. So in light of this very classical view of what friendship is, I want to go to the question that I said is the title of this talk. Is friendship still possible? If we look at friendship this way, is it still possible? So in light of this understanding of friendship coming to us from the classical tradition, to respond to our original question, is friendship still possible, we need to respond as St. Thomas Aquinas nearly always did by making a distinction. In the absolute sense, friendship is still possible. For it is always possible for the human person to become, he would say, by the grace of God and by a virtuous life, able to will the good of another in a true sense. I mean, if we despair of the possibility that we could really want the good of another person for their sake, that would be a very sad view of the human condition. Paul Waddell, in his book, The Primacy of Love, analyzes Aquinas' view of the centrality of love and friendship in the pursuit of happiness. Waddell identifies the hungers of the powers of the human soul. We know the hunger for friendship. We have been starved for love and affection. We thirst for knowledge and insight, for beauty and wisdom. While these hungers are undeniable and universal, the realization of friendship in the modern world is, although possible, vastly difficult. This is, I think, very difficult. And I would say, for several reasons, that I would invite you to dialogue with me when we finish, whether you agree with these perceptions. So the first, I would say, is a challenge to going beyond use and pleasure. In a very materialistic and often efficiency-driven society, the first temptation on the path to true friendship would be to stop at the mere friendship of utility. We might be tempted to give our time and our attention only to those who bring an obvious and measurable benefit. In an individualistic society, especially one which values personal pleasures, the so-called friendship of pleasure, I think it's even hard to call it a friendship, may produce a certain illusion of friendship for as long as the other brings one some kind of emotional, physical, or material fulfillment. But as already discussed, even for Aristotle, neither of these forms was friendship in its fullest sense. C.S. Lewis observes in his wonderful book, The Four Loves, that friendship does appear less useful than other loves. He writes, "Without eros, none of us would have been begotten, and without affection, none of us would have been reared. But we can live and breed without friendship." He points out something I think that is very interesting. This is C.S. Lewis, that in the ancient and medieval worlds, marked as they were by the glorification of rationality, friendship was held in high esteem. I think that's very interesting, that in a world where thought, pursuit of truth, is a great value, then friendship itself would be a great value because the perception and sharing of a true good is the key to friendship. But he says, and I think it's true, Romanticism's exaltation of nature and of sentiment, of emotion, made friendship seem a weak love in relation to the more passionate stirring of eros. Very interesting. Among the lists of reasons that friendship is held suspect in modernity, Lewis notes a confusion or identification of friendship with eros. Very interesting. That if you mix up friendship and eros, which I think you could arguably say that is the confusion regarding the four loves in the modern world. This confusion, an ongoing challenge to the cultivation of friendship beyond the imperfect friendship of use or pleasure, he ponders writing as follows in The Four Loves. Those who cannot conceive friendship as a substantive love, but only as a disguise or elaboration of eros, betray the fact that they have never had a friend. The rest of us know that though we can have erotic love and friendship for the same person, he agrees that that's possible, yet in some ways nothing is less like friendship than a love affair. Lovers are always talking to one another about their love, but friends hardly ever talk about their friendship. Lovers are normally face to face, absorbed in each other. Friends, side by side, absorbed in their common interest. So with his great style, I think Lewis captures something very, very provocative, actually, that if we confuse eros and friendship, we're not going to find friendship in that mix. Friendship, Lewis contends, is not found by those who seek it in itself. He believes in this gift nature of friendship that was mentioned from the very beginning in the biblical quote I gave from Sirach. Friends, he holds, find a bond in their common pursuit of truth and of shared goals. Lewis says, those who have nothing can share nothing. Those who are going nowhere can have no fellow travelers. If these obstacles to friendship were observable by Lewis in modernity, the postmodern, post-postmodern, whatever you want to call this typical, this period now, skepticism concerning truth and denial of ultimate purpose, compounded with the confusion of eros and friendship, explain a fundamental societal breakdown of friendship. I mean, if you don't believe that there is a truth that we can hold in common, if you don't believe that there is a purpose for our living, a meaning, how can you pursue it together with another person? And therefore, how could you have friendship? Furthermore, failure to move beyond lesser relationships of use or pleasure to true friendship may be examined in light of the personal qualities necessary to make such a transition. In the glossary of his translation of the Nicomachean Ethics, Terence Irwin notes that the imperfect friendship based on pleasure is probably the nearest to modern ways of thinking about friendship. I think that's interesting that, you know, if the shared pleasure is the way we think of friendship, then we're, by that very way of thinking, not going to come to the full understanding of friendship. Such a view implies a fundamental centering on oneself, a perceived inability to transcend one's own good for that of another. If I live only for myself, for the pleasure I can find in the world, then obviously I can't live for the sake of the good I can bring to another. I think those are some of the challenges to friendship that are at the level of going beyond use or pleasure. Next, I'm gonna look at challenges to benevolence. Even if one were alive to the desire for a deeper and truer friendship, in a widespread cultural context of the denial of the very existence of truth, one has to, in a sense, swim against the intellectual tide to assert that there is a true good for the human person that can be discovered beyond subjective preferences. And in a society increasingly focused on self, there's a further need to discover the other as another self, to be drawn outward and upward. Paul Waddell presents Aquinas' fidelity to the Aristotelian view of friendship as resting on the foundation of benevolence. As he writes, if we are somebody's friend, we seek their good and work for their well-being. They, friends, challenge us by calling us to our best self. Friendship demands a person of such generous spirit that he or she will really find joy in another's good. Okay, so just the sheer generosity, the other-centeredness of friendship is a seeming obstacle. Such desire for the good of the other does not stop at mere wishes, but rather inspires actions to bring about the good for one's friend. In a so-called post-Christian world, this is all the more challenging, for the vertical transcendence by which Christ led us no longer to be servants but friends of God can transform our capacity to know and will the good by the gifts of the Holy Spirit. What we can't do by our own strength, we can do by the strength of God. But if this is doubted by many and rejected by even those who say they believe in its possibility, we're in a bind. Without friendship with God, without the Spirit's gift of wisdom, deep friendships amongst humans would be rare and very difficult. Challenges to mutuality. In some ways, I would say mutuality might be the least challenged of the elements of true friendship in the modern world. Regarding the second aspect, Waddell, reflecting on Aquinas' insistence that friendship requires mutual loving, observes that even if one person wants to befriend another, unless our love is returned, its status is kindness, not friendship. To be friendship, the good we want for another has to be shared consciously and intentionally by the friends. In Veritatis Spunder, the Spunder of Truth, by Pope John Paul II, he noted that one of the positive values of this era is a greater understanding of human dignity and an insistence on the rights of each person. It is true, I think, that a certain focus on equality of persons marks the modern world, and this is seen on many levels. However, if this equality is a mere egalitarianism, not rooted in a sense of the universal dignity we have as beings made in God's image, redeemed by Christ, such equality is a fragile notion at best. For even if we were to claim that society has progressed in treating persons as persons, seen in such movements as the equal rights for men and women, or equal opportunities for the wealthy and the poor, yet we increasingly see the challenge of redefining the very notion of personhood that threatens the rights of many people. If personhood rests on a concept of consciousness, autonomy, productivity, or other such factors, the denial of the status and rights of a person to the most vulnerable among us is a sign of a very profound lack of equality, and thus of a lack of the foundation for mutual benevolence, and therefore necessarily an obstacle to friendship. Challenges to communion of life. Where mutuality and benevolence do become possible, there yet remains the communicatio, the sharing of life so essential to true friendship. Waddell describes the third mark of friendship as a unity so deep that it makes of one another self while still preserving the person's otherness. This becoming another self to a friend requires a vulnerability and a relinquishing of control that only the divine friend unconditionally deserves. As Waddell observes, charity fosters vulnerability to God, an openness so exhaustive that we ultimately become defenseless before the love who is our life. While this openness is radical, it does not destroy a person's identity. Waddell explains that the transformation wrought by friendship with God makes us like God, but it does not make us gods. God's love does not destroy ourself. It brings ourself to its ultimate perfection. It is exactly this perfection of otherness, an otherness rooted in the divine goodness, which enables the most splendid flourishing of friendship with God. It is in making God's good our own that we most fully become not God, but ourselves. In both human and divine friendships, the sharing of life rooted in the good, the true, and the beautiful makes us more one with the other and, at the same time, more fully ourselves. In our technological world, we have both bridges and obstacles to this communion, this sharing of life. On the one hand, global interconnectivity may be seen as a plus, given that we can share FaceTime with someone anywhere in the world where we can secure an online connection. On the other hand, the connectivity offered by social media can be deceptive if it is not facilitating more than a superficial contact. Even for Aristotle, it was obvious that conversation was much more than contact. As Aquinas would say, the best life is to contemplate and share with others the fruits of one's contemplation. We might ask ourselves how easy it is to contemplate in the pace of our modern world. Contemplation isn't just taking in information. It's pondering truth. It's pondering the depth of things in order to come to a kind of wisdom. So are we even able to contemplate in the pace of life we live? And further, how often are our conversations really a sharing of the fruits of our contemplation of truth? Friendship is challenging but possible. If we hope to be good friends to others, we must seek to be first the friends of God. St. Thomas Aquinas speaks of the theological virtue of charity precisely as friendship with God, although he admits that this friendship will only be perfect in heaven. Referring to Aristotle's ethics, Aquinas writes in the Summa Theologiae, "Charity signifies not only the love of God, but also a certain friendship with him, which implies, besides love, a certain mutual return of love, together with mutual communion." Aquinas attests that while this friendship with God and charity is possible by grace even in this life, it can only reach perfection in the life to come. He states, "Now this fellowship of man with God, which consists in a certain familiar colloquy with him, is begun here in this life by grace, but will be perfected in the future life by glory, each of which things we hold by faith and hope." He concludes that just as human friendship requires belief and trust in the fellowship possible with another person, so too one must have faith and hope in God and the possibility of genuine communion of life with him in order to live charity as friendship with God. Aquinas demonstrates that friendship with God possesses the qualities of human friendship proposed by Aristotle. It is evident from experience, holds Aquinas, that the love of friendship requires a communication between two friends. This communication, far more than a conversation, is a genuine sharing of one's very life and being with the other. Schockenhoff observes, as applied to God's love for human beings, communicatio means a sharing and commonality that consists in the fact that the triune God gives everyone his own beatitude and calls people to participate in divine life. Prior to the coming of Christ, this seemed possible, if at all, only in a very limited way with the transcendent God. With the incarnation, God introduced a new possibility both for our friendships with him and for our friendships with each other. He chose to dwell among us, thus opening the way to a tangible fellowship, which was evident during the years of the human life of Jesus Christ, but also remains open to us through the grace of the Holy Spirit. This sharing of life, this koinonia, is possible through the participation of the faithful in Christ and the vital union of all Christians with the Son. This union remains open to all through the Church, in the life of the prayer and sacraments, and uniquely in the gift of the Eucharist. Thus, the communicatio of friendship is rich and mutually enriching in both human and divine relationships. If, as Aristotle held, the principal barrier to friendship of humans with God is the lack of equality, this deficit is overcome with the union of the divine and human natures in Jesus Christ. Furthermore, Jesus reveals his express intention of making possible friendship between God and man when he says during the Last Supper discourse recorded in John's Gospel, "You are my friends if you do what I command you. No longer do I call you servants, for the servant does not know what his master is doing. But I have called you friends, for all that I have heard from the Father, I have made known to you." True friendship has never been easy, and we ought not give up. David's battle against his own passions was by far a more fierce battle than his contest with Goliath, but Jonathan's self-sacrificing love helps to liberate him from egoism. John of the Cross had to brave the ascent of Mount Carmel by means of a very dark night to join Teresa along the way of perfection. Lewis had to learn to heed the voice not of Screwtape, but of the supposed enemy, in order to understand and share the true light that suffused Tolkien's Middle Earth. And in the end, all would agree that the effort to know the true good and to surrender to the grace that not only made the knowing, but also the willing for the other's sake possible is worth it. As Erasmo Leva Maricacus writes, commenting on Sirach, "A true friend enables us to break out of the confinement of our isolation by offering us something outside ourselves, as dear to us as our very selves. A true friend does not give us anything. A true friend gives us himself. Jesus taught, for there is no greater love than this, to lay down one's life for one's friends. And the real possibility of loving to this degree is found in Jesus himself, the one who gave and gives of himself that we might share life with him and with the truly best of our friends forever." Thank you.
Thank you so much, Sister. This is full of interesting stuff. And I was hoping I could just get you to reflect aloud a little bit on the role of difference in friendship. Mm-hmm. So in my own experience, mm-hmm. the best friendships are based partly in similitude or something, but also in difference. That mm-hmm. is, the best friends are people who are somewhat alike and somewhat different, because the alike gives you common ground to communicate, and the different makes them interesting. And right, I wouldn't want to just hang out with myself all the time. And that part I didn't hear in Aristotle. Mm-hmm. And so I thought I'd just throw that out there and see how that fits into the analysis you've given us.
I think that the appreciation for difference is broader in the Christian perspective than in the Aristotelian perspective. Because, while I would say this, I don't think Aristotle would discount the fact that there could be difference as long as there was a rooting in a pursuit of some common good, right? But I certainly don't think he would say you have to exclude all difference. But I think that the perception of difference as threatening is reduced in a changing ground for what we see as human equality. I think that the society of ancient Greece, from what I've read of the ancient Greek texts, there was a very limited appreciation of the goodness of difference. Now, that didn't mean, of course, that they all disagreed. I mean, look at the Socratic dialogue recorded in Plato. Certainly, what makes them fruitful dialogues is that they do have difference. But I think that it wasn't as appreciated, I don't think, as a richness. I think that at the human level, at the very natural level, it's easy to perceive difference as a sort of threat. And I think because the social strata of the pre-Christian world were very defined, in a sense, there was a limitation to the appreciation of difference. Whereas my own reading of the Gospels and of the New Testament is that difference doesn't become a substantial threat in the same light, because in Christ there is the potential of a universal brotherhood that is really true, and it's a potential that's open to all, even those who aren't actually participating in it. I mean, there's such a universality. I mean, I just think the ancient worldview was not as appreciating of difference. I think this is something that actually comes with a Christian worldview, is this understanding that all have a universal destination that unites us at a much more fundamental level. And so I appreciate your comment, because I think it's where you could enrich these conversations, is to say, what is that role of difference? I think for both Aristotle and Aquinas, there would have to be, for a virtuous friendship, some likeness at the level of the perception of what a true good is, for there to be a deep friendship. Now, there could certainly be a friendly interchange. I mean, even Aristotle would have said, you're not a virtuous person if you don't have the capacity to be friendly with others. I mean, he thinks that an argumentative person who's just argumentative for the sake of being argumentative is not really a virtuous person. So there is a certain social grace to sharing with those who are different, but I don't think for Aristotle it's a true friendship. Aquinas, I would say, there's a little bit more expanse of the range of difference, but it would still need to be that at some deep level, you really want the true good of the other. So there has to be some likeness, even if on very external. But if the true likeness is grounded in the ultimate reality, in the ultimate end, I think in a sense this gives more space for the other differences between us, right? But it would be actually really interesting to write on that, actually, to write on the enrichment of difference in relation to this concept of likeness. Because I certainly think if you hold the unity at the level of the end, there's great room for difference. Yeah.
Tim,
yeah.
Danny, Tanaka.
Okay, well, I'll just go for it. So we don't have two law folks at the same time. I find on this campus, or more concretely, that there's two extremes. One, the celebration of, you know, your friends should be as different as possible, and my roommates were from three continents and four socioeconomic strata. And then the opposite, I think, possibly temptation is to have friends who only agree with you on everything, mm-hmm. and have the same taste in politics, culture, and everything. Mm-hmm. And I feel like virtue is probably in the mean, but how do you negotiate that in a sort of on a campus environment, if you could kind of apply these ideas to that?
It's interesting. I go back to this, the friendliness should be with all, because I think what most people are calling this, I have friends who are totally diverse from what I am, is friendliness, which is actually supposed to embrace many. I mean, we're supposed to remain open. Thomas Aquinas was a big fan of truth wherever you found it. And if you narrowly think you possess the fullness of truth all by yourself, you're not going to be friends with anybody. I mean, it's very self-enclosed. And I think that would be a danger you'd want to avoid. I mean, it's not virtuous, actually, to be self-enclosed. So in the sense that we want to be as broad in our understanding of difference as we can at the level of friendliness, I think is part of virtue. But I do think that when Scripture, Aristotle, Aquinas talk about friendship as a rare experience, they're not talking about my campus-wide social network. They're talking about amongst my campus-wide social network.
Community.
There's a person I really have communion with at the level of a shared truth that binds us together. And that is why it's rare, right? That's why it's rare. Because, I mean, yes, be friendly with many. But the one to whom I would really share friendship at the level of a deep, deep interpersonal exchange is we have to have some shared perception of the good. Now, that doesn't have to be in a particular circle, because a person from a totally different cultural background, and even, I would say, even a different religious background, could come to a shared perception of the good with you that is really profound. I was sharing with Amy, actually with Evelyn, on the way here, that one of my best friends, I'll never forget it, when I was studying at university as an undergraduate, before I was a sister, I was pretty committed to the fact that I was probably going to become a religious sister. And so my faith at that stage was very important and central in my life. And someone came to me and said, I want you to meet this guy because he's like the most like you person I've ever met, and he's an atheist. And I thought it was funny that they had to describe our likeness but our difference in the same sentence. Okay, and I thought, well, so I met him. And in fact, he's one of the best friends I've had in my life. And I thought it was interesting that we did have a common perception of the true good, but his was rooted in a philosophic understanding of goodness, and mine was rooted in my understanding of God and God's revelation of that goodness, but it actually had a very parallel understanding of what is the true good. And so my life choice became utterly inexplicable to him, except for on the level that he thought he trusted that my perception of goods must be such that it drew me in this direction. But I think it's interesting that I think if it's really rooted in the true good, it's not superficial. So I think when we say, well, you know, oh, look how diverse I am. I've got a friend who plays this sport. I've got one who speaks this language or whatever. I'm like, well, that's nice, okay? But we're not talking about we're just friendly. Friendship, as this kind of idea, is far deeper than the differences that are part of who we are. They're not unimportant, but they're not the core of who we are. And I think to really be able to walk with another person at the depths of friendship, our ultimate understanding of goodness has to have a strong commonality. That doesn't mean we have to go to the same church. It doesn't mean we have to think all the exact same things or carry the party card. You know, I mean, but it does mean that we have to want a true good that we have a union in, so we can will it for the sake of the other. I mean, if my friend thinks the true good is something that I completely disagree with, how can I agree in willing that good for them? I mean, so I can be friendly with all, I mean, people who have very different perceptions of the good. I have many, in that sense, friendships. But I think the people that we're going to really confide our thoughts to and be enriched most by that shared communion of life, there has to be a shared perception at a deep level. But there's no that one definition except that it is the true good. I don't think that has to come in categories that box us in. And sometimes we're surprised, you know. I mean, we definitely need to learn, I think, from the friendly interactions we have with many. And, you know, a virtuous person is, this is the thing, if you stand in truth, that doesn't make you narrow. It makes you actually very open. Because if I'm open to seeking the truth, I don't have to be afraid that what is true in your statement is coming from a different label, a different group, a different whatever. I mean, if it's true, it's true. I think when you read Aquinas, he obviously read incredibly broadly. At a time when it was totally out of fashion, he used Jewish thinkers, Muslim thinkers, he used pagans from Greece, okay, to talk about his own idea of truth, because he was taught by a great man. Albert the Great, the scientist who taught Thomas Aquinas, was truly a great thinker. And he taught Aquinas to look for truth wherever you find it. And so he never saw the world as narrow and self-enclosed. He had a great expansiveness of mind and heart. And I think that I hope this answers your question to some level. On a university campus, the enrichment of being around people who come from many different backgrounds, many different ways of thinking, is a great enrichment. And I may be surprised by who I might share a common pursuit of a true good with. So in the sense of staying open in my social interactions, I think this is very important for all of us, right? But then being rooted in a common understanding of the true good is what bridges. And what, you know, it's interesting, one of the quotes I gave is that you can't choose it. It's not like I set out and say, oh, because I think you're going to agree with me, I'm going to become friends with you. But that as you share life with another person, you perceive a common grounding in the desire for the good of the other. That is what both forms friendship, and then the friendship forms you, as I said. And actually what happens is, you and your friend, you will always have your differences. Remember I said you have to preserve the otherness. It's not a unity that destroys the individuals. It's a unity that enriches both of the individuals. So it's not like a kind of blending. It's not like you become, the other isn't another self as in like, we're so one that everything they like, I like everything. You know, I mean, no. It's, we so want the good of each other that we give each other that kind of grounding in freedom that comes with true love. Friendship is one of the four loves. Okay, that enables the other to become most fully what they're meant to be. A true friendship does that, right? You become most what you're meant to be. And so while it has a deep unity, it also has a preservation of the otherness. It would be a rather immature notion of friendship, I think, to say that it's a likeness that's at some superficial level or a likeness that is forced. It's a concord that happens by the very fact that there is a common truth, a common good that you seek.
I was struck by the mention of Aristotle's line about friendship making bad men worse and good men better. I thought of kind of the analog of conscience, where like, you know, making bad choices obviously makes you worse, good choices good. But there's something in Aquinas about a certain degree of value from following one's conscience, even when it's mistaken. You know, I don't want to state that too imprecisely, it could be corrected. But does that have any application in thinking about friendship? This is the only example I can think of, but like the idea of like not snitching, right, on your, you know, on the criminal who's your friend. Is there some degree of goodness in that? Is, you know, the loyalty shown to one's friend, even though the friend is a criminal, and you know, is that supposed to guide any kind of action or response in terms of like how you should approach, you know, a friendship that you think is unhealthy, about like seeing the good in it versus simply saying like, no, you need to separate yourself, you're forming yourself in a bad direction.
It's a good question, this influence of the good and the evil. And I think, you know, there can be goods at different levels. And, you know, that's, for example, when Aristotle talks about why he separates the intellectual virtues from the moral virtues, really, is there's a way in which a thing can be good, even but it's immoral. So you can say actually someone is a good at robbing banks because they're very clever, right? They can do it, they can defy the security system, and that's a kind of a good, but it's not a moral good, okay? So for a person who's convinced that there is moral good in this life and that we ought to be pursuing it, that would color the way we perceive friendship, right? That it's not just the fellowship of two thieves, right? But that it's actually, if I really want to befriend this other, I'm not just in fellowship with them, but actually want to lead them to a moral good. And in that case, you would have to be, I mean, the whole idea of telling what another has done. I mean, in an ideal friendship, if a person sees that another is hurting themselves by their choices and actions, I think ideally that would begin a friendship, I mean, a conversation one-on-one, right? That you speak to the other and convince them to pursue the good, right? So you them to pursue the good of getting the help they need to change the pattern, or them pursuing the good of turning themselves in if that's the just thing, you know? And I mean, if there were some way in which a person perceived, and this is where prudence, the good old virtue of prudence, guides all good moral action, right? How to act in a given situation that is really for the good of the other. But if one were to approach another, and if the person were seriously harming themselves, we're not talking about just holding a problematic opinion, okay, but seriously harming themselves, and my pursuit of that with them in a conversation where I try to convince them that they need to get some help or whatever, and if that doesn't produce fruit, if I discern in prudence that needs to involve an action of telling another something, well, I'd have to discern whether it's for their true good. I mean, if they're really my friend. I mean, even in professional relationships, this whole guarding of secrets thing, I mean, if somebody's going to reveal to me something that has the potential to be something that I need to take further action on, I don't guarantee a keeping of a secret, right? I'm with anybody, with a friend or a business associate, because I say, I promise you I will never reveal something that you've revealed to me unless I perceive that it would be to your good. And in that case, I will tell you first. Okay, I mean, and it's a fair deal, right? I've never had somebody not reveal whatever they were planning to reveal just because of that I know of. I mean, they always say, oh, because I said, I'm about your true good. So if you're sharing with me something that I see, oh, there's another who needs to know this, or there's an action that's consequent to this, that I would pursue it with the friend themselves. Now, if there were an extreme situation of self-harm and the person couldn't move themselves, then I would take whatever reasonable steps would help that person, even if that person perceived that I was against them. Because I would hope I was a true friend to them, I would love them and want their good more than I wanted the association with them. And I think that comes under that part about, for the sake of the good of the other, you might even have to separate yourselves at time from them. And even when I talk to people about, okay, this question of, so do I remain in association with people who their life choices are very different than my vision of the moral good, and how do I know, can I remain in that relationship? A lot of it is not a judgment of them, it's a judgment of yourself. Because you have to be honest enough in the moral life to say, for one, am I able to bring a good into this person's world? I mean, if there's no benefit, if I'm not able to bring a good into their world, am I really willing their good if I'm just kind of congratulating their bad behavior? Okay. If I'm enabling their bad behavior, maybe I'm not meant to remain in their world. But also you have to be honest about your own human integrity and strength and weakness. So, I mean, if you look and you say, every time I'm with that person, it's an association in what is not good, then to say, I might have to step back from relationship, not because I'm condemning the other, but because I recognize my own weakness. And I'm called to love them the way I'm called to love myself. If I really want to pursue goodness and I'm not strong enough to pursue it in the context of a relationship where the choices made are really destructive of both of us, then to step out of that is not condemnation of another. It's actually admission of your own inability to stand in that relationship, to bring a good to the other and to preserve the good in yourself. And so sometimes we have to back away from a relationship that is... And actually, I mean, I believe in the power of prayer. I believe that one of the greatest goods you can do for another person is your prayer for them. And sometimes your disassociation with a very hurtful pattern of life can help another person to step into it freely, not by your coercion. You're not like manipulating by your choice. You're saying, if I, being in your company, am not helping you to become a better person, then I'm not befriending you. And it would be false to pretend I am, you know? And so to step out of that, I think, can be a great charity, actually.
We might leave it there, but thank you so much, Sister Mary Madeline. We might thank you one more time, and I invite you to go up and talk to her at the end if you'd like.